Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals are provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information. The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed in this podcast are solely of those of the hosts.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris, the Chumanchu. I'm joined tonight by my co-hosts, Sam and Sydney. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hey, Chris.
Tonight is our guest, Dr. Praveen Gaday, to discuss the new AAP guidelines on faltering weight. But first, Sam, do you want to remind us what's going on with our show?
Sure. So we are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
Tonight, we have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Praveen Gaday. Dr. Gaday is a graduate of Madras Medical College. He is currently serving as the Vice President of the American Society for Parenteral and Enteral Nutrition, or ASPEN. He has been recognized by several societies for his work in pediatric nutrition and has received the Distinguished Nutrition Support Physician Service Award from ASPEN in 2018, the Master Educator Award for Sustained Educational Scholarship from the North American Society for Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition, otherwise known as NASPGHAN, in 2021, and honorary membership of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics for distinguished contributions to the field of nutrition in 2022. Dr. Gaday's research interests include multiple efforts to improve feeding, nutrition, and growth in children with diverse diseases. Dr. Gaday teaches us about the definition of faltering weight, when to test, and how to supplement calories.
I guarantee we will not falter to provide a good episode on this one.
Yeah!
Love it.
Before we get to the episode, we would like to provide financial disclosure for Dr. Gaday, who discloses financial relationships with Kate Farms and Nutricia for research support and Abbott for consulting fee. All relevant financial relationships have been reviewed and mitigated in accordance with CME standards. The content of this episode is intended to be fair, balanced, and evidence-based, and these relationships have not influenced the educational material presented. Let's get into it. Well, welcome back. Hi, Dr. Gaday. Thanks for coming on the show.
It's great to be here. I'm looking forward to doing this podcast.
Excellent. First, because we're in a formal group, is it okay if we call you by your first name?
Absolutely.
All right. So Praveen, we'd like to sort of start off with a couple of rapid-fire questions just so the audience can get to know you a little better. Could you give us a couple lines to describe yourself and maybe something outside of medicine you like to do?
I was thinking about this. One-line description would consist of three alliterations. I was trying to decide between baby whisperer and kid crazy, but then I chose kid crazy. It's sort of an alliteration. I have nutrition nerd, and I have lifelong learner. So I went from zero to almost expert in Spanish over the last 9 years.
Wow.
So that's one thing I really, I have a passion for.
I just want to give a round of applause. I did in Sydney in college, 4 semesters in a row, tried to learn Spanish, didn't work. My brain couldn't do it. I think I lost the plasticity, and I'm so impressed that you have this now.
I doubt it. I doubt you lost the plasticity. I'm sorry to say you just didn't try hard enough.
Didn't try hard enough. didn't put in the effort. That's fair enough.
Dr. Praveen.
I like it. I like it, though. It's inspiring, and I got to go back and doing it. All right. Sydney, take it away. Next question.
Yeah. Can you, Praveen, share a book with us that you love or that you think every doctor and nurse practitioner and provider should read?
I really like The Checklist Manifesto by Atul Gawande. I don't know if you've read it, but he talks about the relationship between why airplanes sometimes fail and how we sometimes fail our patients by not using checklists. And so it's a really good read. And it's not a big book. So you should consider reading it.
Well, Atul Gawande, he's written quite a few books, I think, that have been mentioned throughout the years. I mean, if they pick any of those books, I think they'll have some good ones. I have not read The Checklist Manifesto, but I do know that you know, throughout the times when I was a med student resident, you know, there's a lot of discussion about and comparison between the airline industry as well, checklists. And we had a checklist before we started the podcast as well. So I definitely believe in all those.
And the timeout, if you ever go to the operating room and you do a timeout, that's based on a study that he did or in five continents. It was published in an EJM. So just some background.
Awesome. And so I'll take the next question, and we'll kind of make this our final question before we jump to the case. Sometimes we ask best advice, but I was wondering if we could go with best or favorite failure. Did you have a favorite failure, and what did you learn from it?
One more alliteration, right? Favorite failure.
Yes.
So I started my first job after my fellowship thinking I would set up what's called a nutrition support team, where I would figure out who needed parental nutrition and all this stuff in a children's hospital. I tried for almost 10 years or maybe even longer and never succeeded. But in the bargain, I set up one of the best pediatric clinical nutrition departments from scratch in a hospital. So even though you may not get what it is you think you want, you might end up with something else equally good, if not better.
That's a great, great, great piece of advice also. Even though we were going favorite failure here, that's like a fantastic piece of advice. I feel like we get that a lot in academic medicine as well. You know, just keep your doors open, your eyes open, and keep working on what you love to do. And something's going to come, and not what you expect, but it's going to end up being something just as good, and you're going to be really proud of it at the end. So that's perfect. So maybe we'll get into the case. Sydney, if you wouldn't mind taking it away and let's see what we think about these new practice guidelines. If you're a busy physician, nurse practitioner, PA, medical student, or other healthcare professional, you know that your morning routine is measured in minutes, not hours. Between getting ready and making it to rounds or clinic on time, there's not much room for a complicated makeup routine. And especially during the summer, where you'd rather spend those extra few minutes outside or with your family than standing in front of a mirror, products that simplify your routine can make a real difference. That's one of the reasons why Jones Road Beauty has become such a popular choice. Their Miracle Balm is designed to enhance your skin instead of covering it up, giving you that effortless, your skin but better look. You don't need brushes or a drawer full of products. Just use your fingers, blend it in, and you're ready to go in under a minute. It's also perfect for summer travel. Whether you're packing for a vacation, traveling for work, or just heading away for a weekend, you don't need to stuff an entire makeup bag into your suitcase. Miracle Balm can work as a highlighter, brush, bronzer, or lip tint, so a few products can replace a much bigger routine. And if you want a little more coverage without going back to a full face of makeup, Jones Road just launched their new Foundation Stick. It gives buildable, medium to full coverage while still feeling incredibly lightweight and looking like real skin, not heavy or cakey. So, Cribsetters listeners, Jones Road Beauty is modern-day makeup that's clean, strategic, and multifunctional for effortless routines. For a limited time, our listeners are getting a free full-size mascara on their first purchase when they use code CRIBSIDERS at checkout. Just head to jonesroadbeauty.com and use code CRIBSIDERS at checkout. After your purchase, they will ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and let them know that we sent you.
So our case is of Wyatt, who is a four-month-old boy who was brought to Cashlack Children's Primary Care for a routine well child visit. When you review his growth chart before going into the room, you notice that his weight is currently in the third percentile and has progressively declined since birth, crossing two major percentile lines. His length is 25th percentile and head circumference is 50th percentile. His weight for length Z-score is negative 1.8. When you go in to see him, his mother reports that Wyatt is exclusively breastfed and feeds every 3 to 4 hours during the day and once overnight. He generally feeds well, but is sometimes fussy and stops feeding after 5 to 10 minutes. He has 6 to 8 wet diapers daily and regular stools. His mother denies vomiting, diarrhea, or any respiratory symptoms. Developmental milestones are appropriate for his age. On your first impression, Wyatt is alert, interactive, and well-appearing. So just to start us off, how is faltering weight defined? And can you talk to us about this new diagnostic criteria and how and why it's changed?
Well, failure to thrive had to go, right? It's pejorative. Nobody likes it. The parents hate it. We hate it too. And we had to come up with something. We wanted to come up with something that served as screening criteria, so that pediatricians would recognize weight problems early and tackle them before they became a problem. So that's why faltering weight versus faltering growth. Okay. With regard to the diagnostic criteria, they seem like a handful, but in reality, they are not. Because the first thing it says is we need to think about weight not just by itself, but using an index of proportionality. So you have to use weight for length or BMI. And we came up with the cutoff of negative 1.65 Z-score, which is roughly the fifth percentile. Now, when you think about the fact that some children drop percentiles, and we used to use this, it's not very accurate to know how many percentiles a child has to drop before it becomes problematic. Because the drop from 90 to 70 is not the same degree of drop as from the 20 to the first percentile. One of the reasons to use Z-scores is that it evens out that process. Wherever you drop one Z-score, the degree of drop is bad. So that's the second way that you think about this, which is if weight for length, or BMI Z-score drops by one Z-score, then it becomes concerning. Okay. The last one is a complex way of thinking about it. We want babies to gain weight. And, you know, there's a lot more weight gain over the first 2 years of life. And the WHO released some charts which tells us what are Z-scores for weight gain. And so -2 Z-score for weight gain is also available for at 1 month, 2 month, 3 month, 4 month, and 6 month intervals. So let's say you saw a child at 9 months, and again, you see the child at 12 months. There is a -2 Z-score weight above which the child should be. And if the child doesn't do that, then that's one more reason to think of the child having faltering weight. So I said three things. One is the weight for length, less than -1.65. The second is the drop in Z-score. And the third is this weight gain velocity being above a particular number. So those are the three things I said.
So you've mentioned this Z-score several times. Can you explain it a little more? Because I don't know if I completely understand, or maybe you can remind some of the audience as well. Like, exactly what is a Z-score, and what do these numbers actually mean?
So Z-score is a standard deviation score. And when you go back to your stats class, you can think of the bell curve. So the bell curve, the middle is the median, right? Right in the middle, there's a line, and that's the Z-score of zero. And as you move towards the fifth percentile, you are now gradually moving towards smaller and smaller numbers, and you are at -1.65 at the fifth percentile, and then the -2 is roughly the 2.3 percentile. Okay, so and then there's -3, and so on. One of the important reasons to use Z-scores is one thing I told you about. The drop in Z-scores is even across the spectrum. That's one. The second thing is, once you're below the first percentile, we keep saying so many squares below the first percentile and things like that, things which are very inaccurate. So to make it objective, we can say Z-score of -3.2 or whatever else. The other really nice thing is, if you have an electronic medical record and you pull up the growth chart and you saw this child 4 weeks ago and the Z-score was -3.2, and you've done whatever you've done and the child is now gaining weight well, and you hover above the weight, you see that the Z-score is now -3.08. So the child is moving in the right direction. It gives you one more little piece to tell you that the child is doing better.
So I love that we've defined this, both defined Z-score and defined what we would consider to be growth faltering. I just want to quickly, before we go into kind of some management and or diagnostic recommendations, I wanted to talk a little bit about inclusion-exclusion criteria. So one of our last guidelines that we did with the febrile infant guideline, for example, and exclusion and inclusion criteria were very important in this case. In this guideline that you have for us here, were there any ages, weights, infants, older kids, anything like that that was included and excluded that we should know about when it comes to making these definitions and doing the following practices?
So not explicitly, okay? And I want to caution the listeners that some of this is is expert opinion. I worked on this guideline for a long time and I know it inside and out, but this is not what the AAP necessarily thinks. So some of what I will be saying is what I am saying and not what the AAP is saying. One important thing is I don't think the same rules apply for preemies before they hit term. So we have to be careful about that, though we didn't explicitly call that out. The second thing is that if you already started dropping height and you qualify for malnutrition that way, those children are not included because the whole point of this guideline is to prevent that. So remember that just saying, oh, your height sucks because you've not grown for years, that doesn't qualify as faltering weight because you're way beyond that. You need care, and that is, I suppose, an exclusion.
Yeah, no, I think that's very good to comment, especially as we get into the next steps here. So one of the big components is talking about a focused history and physical for these patients. That's a big decision-making point when we decide what to do next. We're wondering if you have any recommendations of good components that we should get after, physical exam history, any special considerations based on age that we should know about.
I think in every age group, a good dietary history is important. It's as important in babies as it is in teenagers. As we all know, as pediatric providers, that the way you get that information is different in different age groups. In babies, you're trying to figure out if they came out with something wrong, right? So you have to focus a lot more on the nitty-gritty. Is this baby neurologically normal? Could there be a genetic condition? Those kinds of things. As the child gets older, those things become relatively obvious. So then the physical exam, I'm not trying to say that the physical exam is less important, but then you do a more focused physical exam, make sure there's nothing else going on, and go from there.
One quick question about the nutrition history. I would love to know, obviously, to your point with a baby, it's very straightforward exactly what they're taking in, but any recommendations for how to take a really good nutrition history for an older kid?
Okay, well, first thing is, it's not relatively straightforward with a baby because breastfed babies, you need to know what you're looking for. And simple things are, how often is the baby going to the breast? Is the baby feeding from both breasts? Too long and too short are both problems. So if the baby's getting off the breast in 2 minutes, then that's a problem. If the baby's sitting on the breast all day long, then that's a problem too. So those are things to think about. And in this case, this baby was peeing and pooping fine and all of that stuff, but breastfed babies are not getting enough, typically tend not to poop very well because there's not enough going into the system, for example. Okay. With a nutrition history in children, it gets complicated. So the ideal way to get it is to figure out what happens during the weekday. One weekday and one weekend day would be ideal. But once the child goes to school, if the child gives you a good history, then that's fine. But otherwise, you have to rely on a variety of things to try and get a sense of what is going on. The high ticket items that you have to figure out are grazing and juice or other sugar sweetened beverages. So if the child is eating all the time, that I tell parents that if I had a clone of your child and I gave one food all day long and the other child just meals every 3 hours, meals and snacks at every 3 hourly intervals, the child who's getting the meals and snacks at regular intervals will grow better. Okay. Juice seems to fill up some children's bellies and prevent them from growing. So cutting out juice and cutting out grazing are two very simple and important things that should be done with anybody that is that has faltering weight.
So one thing that I've come across often in my clinic is that, going back to sort of our newborns is, for many of our parents, our first time parents and other things, we run into the issue where maybe they're just not mixing the formula correctly and maybe the baby's just not getting enough calories. And so often there's a lot of times between, physician or we actually have we've been very lucky to have a dietitian in our clinic to help with some of this. Our dietitian is also, also helps teach breastfeeding as well. So is able to help in a lot of different ways. As I think about our patients who run into problems with, you know, education and things like that, could you talk a little bit about maybe other like social determinants of health that may affect faltering weight and how you sort of ask some of those questions?
Okay. I just want to talk about bottle feeding for 1 second.
Okay.
Most formulas are 1 scoop to 2 ounces. So everybody should know that. And any child that's not growing very well, we need to get that story. Right now, we have a lot of European formulas, more European formulas coming on the market, and they can be 1-to-1. But if somebody is mixing a formula to less than 1:2, say 1:3, that is definitely dilute. And so that baby's not getting enough calories from the milk. That's a simple fix. Okay, social determinants of health. There are two ways to think about it. In my hospital, I am in a way lucky because we have the questions already asked of the parents and they fill them out. And we are told whether there are any social determinants that are of concern or not. Okay. With regard to faltering weight, you have to think about it in two different ways. One is that a low socioeconomic status does not make the child more likely to have faltering weight. Okay, but at the same time, you want to know their socioeconomic status so that you can help them. Right? Because then you can connect them to WIC or SNAP or all of those kinds of benefits that they may be eligible for, but not participating in. So you have to keep this two-sided approach to this. And in a way, for me, it's easy because it's already there. And then I have to only deal with, can I help you with WIC or SNAP or whatever else that I need to pull up?
So I'm going to take us a little bit back to our case, Wyatt. So like any basic visit or good visit, you know, from a physician and or a practitioner who starts off, we're taking that good history and physical exam. You know, we're always doing that. We kind of walk through Wyatt, we said, was exclusively breastfed, feeds every 3 to 4 hours during the day, once overnight. We even said feeding about 5 to 10 minutes, we'll say both sides, and with 6 to 8 wet diapers daily in regular stools. We'll say otherwise relatively asymptomatic. And then we move on to the next question. You know, the big thing that we want to know out of these guidelines and recommendations is, what are we supposed to do for testing? Are we supposed to test? Are we not supposed to test? Who are we testing? And if you wouldn't mind kind of walking us through that, maybe we can give you some changes to the case and talk about some differences as we go.
Again, the general guideline is not to test right up front. Okay. This baby looks like a rose, except that he has faltering weight. Okay, so with this child, the first step is to intervene. And knowing that a lack of calories is 98% of the time the problem, that's where we intervene. Okay, for this particular baby, I might think about one more breastfeed at night. I don't know, the baby's kind of getting old and mom, it's hard for moms, right? So then the other question is, do we talk about supplementing, you know? And that would be the easiest thing, but then, you know, it's a shared decision making. That being said, I really want this baby to gain some.
So the way I see it is, you're saying, hey, most babies, it's a caloric intake problem. We don't need to test if they don't have any other symptoms or anything that we're worried about specifically. Therefore, we're going to use treatment methods, and we'll talk about what the treatment methods are instead. But essentially, the treatment methods are diagnostic. And if we essentially treat or intervene, as you put it, and this baby starts to gain weight on us, we feel like we've solved and or are fixing this problem.
Absolutely.
Now I'm going to make this a little bit harder for you. I'm curious if there, and this could be expert opinion rather than guideline-based medicine here, but I'm going to start to give you some symptoms, and I'm curious if there are specific tests that you would recommend based on some of the symptoms we get. So right now we gave this baby relatively asymptomatic across the board. Now let's start adding vomiting to the mix. How does that change what you would do regarding testing or not?
Okay. It really depends on how much vomiting is there. Okay. For example, are they spit ups or are they vomiting? It would be a little bit easier if this baby were formula fed, but you're not making things easy for me. So The other thing I would think about is there any family history of atopy, for example, right? If the child has eczema, blood in the stool, whatever else, I hate to take anybody off the breast, but I might have mom eliminate cow's milk, for example. I, of course, want to make sure it's not bilious or bloodstained or whatever else kind of vomiting, right? I might also, depending on how bad the vomiting is, maybe try an added rice formula as the supplement for a little bit and see if I can push this baby over the top, right? So depending on the exact case, if the vomiting is alarming, I don't think so based on the weight and everything else that you presented to me, then I might consider doing more testing.
Yeah, I guess what I was trying to do here, and we can kind of keep work our way through this, is trying to wonder if there is a almost like an illness script or buckets to say, okay, if you got this plus this, then do these tests. This plus this, do these tests. Because it sounds like it's not very specific in the recommendations on which tests you would do for what symptoms. Is that correct?
I don't think you want to be prescriptive.
Okay.
I gave you five different kinds of vomiting, right?
Right.
And saying do all of these tests means lots of babies are going to get lots of tests for nothing.
Right. Right. And so let's walk through kind of lots of different symptoms. And I think we can probably summarize this at the end, which is probably going to be, hey, you're going to have to just treat these individually and maybe change your mind and say, okay, use these symptoms and then add growth faltering to that and figure out your differential diagnosis as you walk past it. But let me just add some other symptoms here and see if this gets us anywhere, and then we can circle back around. So what about changes in stool patterns? So let's say we have a patient who has either lots of constipation or, you know, in this case, we'll just go with excessive diarrhea. Again, anything that would automatically come to mind, anything that we should test specifically.
So when you're talking about a 3-4-month-old with excessive diarrhea, the odds are that it's probably a milk protein intolerance. Okay, there's lots of weird stuff that we see, but that would be the most usual thing here. And then I would probably deal with it through maternal elimination of cow milk.
All right.
Constipation too. Terrible constipation can tell you one of two things. One is the baby's not getting enough calories, but you have to remember that children with Hirschsprung's disease don't grow very well. Okay, so but they tend to have abdominal distension, they tend to have vomiting, and they tend to have infrequent but not hard stool, crazily enough.
And then the nice thing about this is we're talking about these giant symptoms as a whole, but check out some of our other episodes that might include these topics that may or may not come out by the time this episode is released.
F-pies.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So those are some GI symptoms, but oftentimes we have patients who come in with cardiorespiratory symptoms as well and faltering weight. Anything that you would do or change differently based on abnormal vital signs, including tachypnea?
I think one important thing to think about is before I deal with the tachypnea, thinking about a murmur. A baby with a little murmur who's not gaining weight, it's very unlikely that the murmur is the cause of the poor weight gain. Babies with cardiorespiratory failure typically have poor intake, and that's one of the cardinal reasons why they don't grow. They may have some increased need for calories, but that tends to be secondary. So you need to suspect cardiorespiratory reasons in kids with PPD, for example, and those kids are breathing a mile a minute, you know, and have other problems. So with the tachypnea alone, more than lung disease, I'm thinking about metabolic problems, you know. So in that case, I might do a urine and a blood to see if this kid is acidotic for some reason. So.
Right. And I'm going to bring up a couple more, but I'm starting to gain a theme, and I think we can, and I think I'll summarize this part of the end. But if, you know, we keep going with more things, what about skin changes?
So skin changes, I think we were talking about nutritional deficiencies that are seen, right? We're not talking about a kid who looks well. If you see skin changes which are suggestive of nutritional deficiencies, that kid needs to be worked up. You have to figure out what this kid is eating, more important, what the kid is not eating, and then intervene.
Yeah. And then here's an interesting one. What about failure to meet developmental milestones?
This is a very common problem in children who have faltering weight, primarily because when you think about the three things that babies do, right? They eat, and they pee and poop, and they cry, right? And if one of those is not going to work well, it's usually the not eating part. And that feeding problems were a common first sign of cerebral palsy. And so when we see failure to meet milestones, we're trying to figure out what is the global problem here, and is faltering weight just part of that?
Right. And I think that's the theme, actually. I'm glad you said that, because I think that's the theme you've been kind of getting at here, which is that faltering weight seems to be a symptom of some of the other things that we're referring to. So if you have a patient, you know, you have a four-month-old who's coming in with excessive vomiting and diarrhea, maybe you'd work that up and realize, okay, this baby also has, you know, faltering weight, which makes this a little bit more urgent, I would say, but doesn't actually change the diagnosis. Actually, the symptoms of vomiting and diarrhea are actually probably the primary thing you would go after. And so I can see how whatever else is part of this, that's how you would choose to work it up and go after it. That's how you would do it. That's kind of the theme I'm getting. Do you think that's accurate, or am I missing something else?
Absolutely accurate.
Okay. Awesome. Now, this is the last question I kind of have about this workup and testing, because this is, I think, what a lot of our listeners want, and also a lot of our, you know, learners as well, who are trying to do the right thing, right, when this patient comes to them and they're like, oh no, I have faltering weight, and I'm trying to figure out what I need to do rather than just give calories back. The guideline mentions some things to consider workup for, and it is relatively ambiguous as well. Say things like how severe the malnutrition is, time since diagnosis, maybe a family history, persistent faltering weight, words like that. I was wondering if you had any definitions for those, like what is severe? How do you define that? How long is long, for example? How long is, you know, persistent? If we can kind of put those in, I can't remember what the word I'm trying to say, but you understand what I'm trying to say.
So severe malnutrition has been defined by the WHO. It's a Z-score of -3. Okay. So weight for length or BMI Z-score less than -3 is severe malnutrition. If height is also affected because of nutrition, not because the kid's parents are short, then severe malnutrition is -3 Z-score again for height. So that those definitions for severe malnutrition are available elsewhere. So that's one. So time from diagnosis, this depends on the age of the child. If a child is 6 months old and hasn't gained weight since birth, that's a long time. And so that would freak me out. Whereas if you're talking about long time in a 7, 8, 9-year-old, I'm thinking of 1.5, 2 years. Okay. So those were two things. Family history, you're asking for every kind of family history, right? You're asking what else is going on in your family. But the things that we think about are, I'm a gastroenterologist, so celiac disease, inflammatory bowel disease. But it could be something else that's really weird and is presenting in this chart.
I do want to ask a just very quick thing about celiac disease. Having listened fairly recently to our episode on celiac disease, the presenter, who obviously had it top of mind, was kind of saying that is one of those things you should just always be testing for. With these guidelines in mind, always be testing for when you have symptoms that are even mildly concerning. With these guidelines in mind, is that one of the first tests that you would be turning to? Kind of at what point are you saying, okay, we don't need to do this thorough workup, but let's at least do celiac and maybe thyroid, a couple other things?
Yes, that is true of celiac disease. The one thing is, the tests for celiac disease, when you do them before the child turns 2, are a little bit more complicated. So in children above the age of 2 who have not responded to the first round of calorie supplementation, considering celiac testing is not at all unreasonable.
And then, you know, I think we're going to get to this when we talk about caloric, you know, supplementation, et cetera. But we might as well finish this off anyways. When it comes to evaluation purposes, diagnosis, et cetera, do you recommend any subspecialty involvement, whether that be GI, speech and language pathology, OT, anything like that to help in this diagnostic standpoint? Or again, are we doing, let's intervene first, see what happens, and then respond in the way that things go?
I think I think I would answer that in two ways. I think everybody deserves a shot at calories. But if you're really worried, you have a three-month-old, not the baby that we were talking about, who seems to be feeding okay. But if feeding seems to be a problem, then you start the calorie stuff, but then you get the OT or some sort of feeding therapist involved early. Right? And babies under the age of one, especially under the age of 6 months, if you're worried about their ability to first feed and swallow and then chew and swallow, then you do want to get somebody involved. I think outside of that, GI would be the big one. But then when there are other symptoms like developmental delay and stuff like that, they go to the relevant subspecialists.
All right. Now, kind of my last question on this front before we really get into some of those management. I'm currently work as a hospitalist. Chris currently and Sydney both work in the outpatient setting. When should this be done in the inpatient setting versus the outpatient setting? Do any of those numbers, for example, as you mentioned, Z-scores, et cetera, definitions, anything implies that we should send this patient inpatient versus trying to do this, all the stuff that we're talking about outpatient?
I've sort of changed my tune on how this should be done over a period of time. And it all depends on the comfort of the clinician who is managing the child outpatient. It also depends on certain other factors like the ability of the family to get to care. And sometimes you see them in the hospital, they live 3 hours away, and this is not going to happen. So you bring them in, take care of them, and send them home. So that's a different problem. Yes, when a child has a Z-score of -4 or something, then I'm going to say, I have no idea what's going on. I need to bring you in. The other thing is sometimes the history doesn't fit. Then you're getting the story that this kid is getting 200 calories per kilo and the kid is -4 Z-score, whatever. Then you know it's going to be very hard to intervene because you're going to tell the parents, give the child 250 calories per kilo, which is not going to work. So that's the next thing. But I have found that some children have not been tried on anything. And admitting them doesn't make sense. So I think when there's either when things are very severe, when the story doesn't make sense, when it's best from a socioeconomic perspective for the family, those are the times when I tend to admit. And I try my darndest anymore not to admit children for this particular problem.
Hey, Cripsiders listeners, whether this is your first episode or you've been with us since day one, you know our goal has always been to share real wisdom about practicing medicine. So let's talk about something that actually changed my day-to-day as a hospitalist, and that's FIG scrubs. I can't walk into a clinic or hospital without seeing people in FIG scrubs, and I get it, I wear them too. They're incredibly soft, form-fitting, and durable, and it's not just dust. If you've been watching a certain popular ER drama on TV, yep, they're in FIGs too. These scrubs get it. That's what drew me in and what keeps me coming back. And because we work with kids and kids come with messes, I love that FIGs are antimicrobial. When stuff gets on your scrubs, and it will, you just wash them and they come out wrinkle-free. I've washed mine well over 50 times and they still look brand new. All of that and so much more is why we've teamed up with FIGs. Now, Cripsiders listeners can get 15% off. Just go to wearfigs.com and use code FIGSRX. That's WEARFIGS.com and use code FIGSRX for 15% off. Sydney, maybe we've been teasing this for a long time as far as the treatment, how to intervene, calories, all that type of good stuff. Maybe you should get started for the next part of the case and then we can hit a lot of our secondary questions here.
Yeah. So moving on with the case. After a thorough guideline-driven history and exam, you explain to Wyatt's mother that he meets the criteria for faltering weight, but that testing isn't currently indicated. She's very anxious about this diagnosis, including what it means for her ability to continue to breastfeed her son. She also notes that the pediatrician who saw his 5-year older brother was also a bit concerned about his declining weight percentiles at his last physical. So using this as a jumping off point, both for the patient in front of us, the 4-month-old, and then his older brother, I would love if you can talk about at different ages, what it looks like to increase calories. And if we're going to talk about the babies as well, I would love to talk about what that looks like both for breast and formula-fed infants.
Yeah, let's talk about the breastfed child. There's really no way to increase the calorie content of breast milk. Yes, you can have the baby selectively feed on hind milk and stuff like that. But, you know, breastfeeding moms are doing exactly a million things. And you have to be aware of that. Typically, there are other children around. All of this stuff is going on. So I tell them that for a short period of time, it would be ideal to give the baby some bottles. And it depends on how much you're able to negotiate. This baby seems to have mild faltering weight, whatever that is. And I would like to get away maybe with either you decide to give 2 or 3 bottles a day or supplement 1 ounce after every feed or something like that. You have to figure it out with that particular mom. I also cheat, and when I supplement to breastfed babies, I use 27 calorie formula with the idea that you are ending up at 24. It's fuzzy math, but that's my logic. And it seems to work okay, and you can get away with a fewer ounces, if you will, by doing 27 calorie formula. For formula fed babies, it's easier. You increase up to 27 calories per ounce, usually typically 24. One formula to kind of, I don't know if I'm supposed to mention formulas, but this is one, there is a 30 calorie per ounce infant formula that's ready to feed. It is available through WIC. It can be used when there are multiple feeders and you're worried about how the bottles are being made. And also in babies who require some degree of fluid restriction. So something else to keep in mind. You can add oils to baby foods. I've not had great success with that. I also worry about babies with dysphagia, because those are babies that we see more often. Some babies with faltering weight, like we already discussed, have other developmental delays, and I worry about their true ability to swallow. So you don't want to be introducing oil into anybody's lungs. So I don't like that. Have I ever done it? Yes, I have. Other people will use other calorie additives. I typically don't do that. I try to go with fortifying the formula. In older children too, when they're at home, yes, you can add. What I tell parents is that with every food that you're giving them, think about an appropriate fat. So I tell them I wouldn't add olive oil to strawberries, because it doesn't make sense. But if you want to put some heavy whipping cream on it, or even some butter, or serve it with some cheese, that seems okay to me. So think about that and do it. I don't know how many parents really follow that, and it can also turn out to be somewhat expensive. So something else to think about. The other thing is, many 30 calorie per ounce beverages are available through WIC, and they are generally well tolerated by children as well. And you can get away by just giving one of those at bedtime and going from there. I also tend to use a lot of these 30 calorie per ounce beverages in older children, because they go to school. And for us to tell them, hey, add more oil to your salad dressing or whatever, is not practical, because they're eating so many meals at school. If you're getting breakfast and lunch at school, that's basically most of your meals. So also, it gives me a way to measure adherence. So I ask them, How many of these beverages have you drunk in the past week? And they tell me 2, then I know it's not happening. Some of them tell me he used to drink 7, now he's drinking about 5 and he's still gaining weight. So then we cut it down some more and see if he's gaining weight, and then cut it out.
I have a couple of quick follow-up questions about different pieces of this, so maybe yes, one at a time. With the increasing the caloric density for formula-fed infants, do you always kind of do it in a stepwise fashion where you go up to 24, then up to 27, just based on how they're doing? Or are there patients? Okay, great.
It's almost always 24. I don't go to 27. I also don't do 22. And I don't use those preemie discharge formulas as a fake way of giving 22. So, which some people do. But I request all pediatric providers to learn how to provide 24 calorie and 27 calorie formula. You just need a cheat sheet, and you should be able to provide families with those recipes.
There's some really good resources online that we can put in the show notes for sure for any clinicians that are looking for those.
So maybe I'll ask actually a follow-up on that part, and then you can go back to your next question. So it sounds like you actually would rather go to automatically go into 24 kilocalories per ounce rather than picking a kilocalories per kilo per day and then dividing that out to see what you would get at.
I think that's impractical, right? I've been doing nutrition for God only knows how long.
This is what we need, and the expert advice. This is great.
Right. I never calculate resting energy expenditure. Pediatricians are seeing children who are eating at least part of what they eat by mouth, right? So you have a baseline. What you're trying to do is increase it by, say, about 10%, okay? The rule of thumb is patient comes in on X calories, you increase it by 10%. Patient comes in on X calories and it's too much, you decrease it by 10%. Occasionally, you think, this kid's growing too fast, a little too fast, we'll go down by 5. So it's 5 to 10% is the increase. So you don't want to be dealing with that. Just go to 24-calorie formula. The baby will decrease his or her intake a little bit. And so you'll end up with a 10% increase.
Fantastic. And I want to point out, you know, as we get to the same thing I'm going to ask for the kind of the toddler or anyone over age one, as you start to move to pediatric formulas, and you've mentioned them as 30 kilocalories per ounce, which for everyone, that's one kilocalorie per milliliter. So if you see a thing that says X 1.0, that's what that means. What do you use in that perspective? Do you end up doing, okay, start twice a day, start four times a day? Like, how do you make that decision? Do you use per kilo per kg per day? How do you generally start? And then we can, of course, increase by 10%, et cetera.
So I just pick, okay. If I think you need a little bit more, I just give it at bedtime, okay? Bedtimes, the reason to give it at bedtime is it doesn't spoil any other meals. I tell everybody a 30 calorie per ounce beverage needs to be in addition to and not a replacement for, because if it's a replacement for, it's just an expensive way of giving somebody calories. So that's not what we're trying to do. Otherwise, some kids won't drink 8 ounces at one go. So then you're 4 ounces after breakfast, 4 ounces after dinner, close to bedtime. Also, one other thing to remember is some children play a lot of sport and they don't make up for those calories after they played their sport. So in those children, I will say that you need to consume this beverage after you played hockey or whatever your favorite sport is.
Perfect. And sorry, we're ping-ponging older kid, baby. But one more baby clarification. In the breastfed infant, when you are adding, let's say if you are doing the 1 or 2 bottles a day rather than the 1 ounce after every feed, how do you recommend timing that so that they are still getting as much of their intake as possible, or at least getting what intake they can from the maternal milk?
It's a little bit of a negotiation and seeing what's going on at home. One thing to think about is, can dad wake up and give a bottle in the middle of the night? Of course, if mom sleeps 8 hours, her supply might go down a little bit. So things to think about like that. And you talk to them and say, this is what I want. What do you think is the best? And then go from there. So there's no right or wrong answer. What you're trying to do is get the baby a little bit of 27 calorie formula and seeing if this baby will grow.
And I'm going to keep ping-ponging back to the older kid. This is starting to get fun. For more of the older kid, you know, we generally think of, as you mentioned, again, 30 kilocalories per ounce beverages. Are there any differences in these things that we should know about? when someone says that, is it a universal? Are there some things that are highly caloric versus others? Because I know in the hospital, for example, we can even give certain puddings or ice creams that are not beverages. Anything you recommend specifically when it comes to drinks versus other ways to supplement calories?
So there are other ways. They require recipes and making. They're not easily transportable. So I'm not saying you can't do all of that. And you can look up recipes online. And our dietitians have recipes and they give them out. I find that the adherence is a little bit lower with them. Like, it's much easier to take something with you that's readily packaged and goes with you. Okay. I'm not suggesting that you can't take avocados and eat them after you played football or baseball or whatever. But I feel like a container of something is much more likely to be consumed. Okay. The other thing that we've not talked about is whether we should use appetite stimulation. Okay. And so it's all fine and dandy to talk about high calorie beverages. When money is tight, it can be very difficult. And if you live in a state where it's hard to come by, in my state, for the most part, in most children, we can get these high-calorie beverages covered, if not by WIC, after the age of 5 through insurance, as long as they have the right diagnosis and they need it. This is not true in every state. Then you may have to lean on things like appetite stimulants. The typical one that everybody likely is familiar with is cyproheptadine. And I do have success with cyproheptadine, and I've used it in all sorts of ages. And previously, there was a little bit of a taboo against using it in very young babies, but we sometimes even use it in them. I don't know if pediatricians are ready to hit the prime time with that, but I think beyond the age of 1, definitely cyproheptadine can be used. I tend to use it just as a single bedtime dose because it's hard to give somebody a chronic medicine that needs to be given 2 or 3 times a day. I also find that it almost always works initially, but after several months, it goes away, even if you cycle it.
Can I ask a couple questions on, you know, we've been talking about how to step up therapy, and you did bring up a little shortly that, you know, say a patient's doing well and they come back and tell you, oh, actually, I'm not drinking as much supplement and my weight's still going up as appropriate. How do you look at, you know, stepping down therapy? I know maybe sometimes the adolescents, they may just do whatever they're going to do. But if you're going to be prescriptive, how do you go about that? What type of approach do you go at that? And at what point are you like, hey, you know, they're no longer faltering weight? Like, what? How do you get to that point?
I think it's just winding down whatever you started. So if this kid is drinking 2 high calorie beverages a day, you make it down to 1 and then you call it off. If they're on medicine, that's the first thing I like to take them off of. So I like to take the cyproheptadine off, and then I try to wind down any caloric supplements that the children are getting. One other thing, because I'm a subspecialist, is some children with feeding problems are faltering weight when they're little, but then they start to become overweight when they start growing up. And part of the problem is, I think, that these parents are conditioned to try and feed their children to try and get them to grow because they were faltering for so long that they never get over it. And so that's something when I discharge them from my clinic, I tell them, you're going to think I'm crazy, but some of these children do end up getting overweight if you don't watch out. So that's something that I discharge them with. As a pediatrician, you're not going to really discharge them from your care, but something to keep in mind.
And as you're peeling off, like, the medication, or you're peeling off supplements, like, how much time are you giving these patients to be on your new prescription of feeds before you decide, okay, they're doing pretty well, and then you make the next step? Is it like 2 months, 3 months, half a year? Is a week enough? How aggressive or slow can you be?
Well, if a baby or a child is gaining weight rapidly and crossing Z-scores the other way, then I would rapidly take things off. But otherwise, you can go a month or two at a time and see how they're doing, and then take it off. It makes everybody relaxed, because the parents also want to see that what you've done is working. And if you're going to do this every week, it also means you're seeing the child every week, which is mostly not necessary in a child that's doing well.
Yeah, maybe that's a good question. So let's just divide this in the kid less than one and the kid over one. How often are you seeing these kids for follow-up, kind of for weight checks and checking in to make sure that our prescription is going well? And if not, we either, number one, need to do more aggressive workup, as we talked about in the first half of the case, or number two, we just got to go up on the calories a little bit.
I think it's dependent on two things. One is the severity of the presentation and the age of the child. In general, the more severe the presentation and the younger the child, the quicker you see them back. And if you see a two-week-old and he's not gained weight since birth, a 3 or 4 week old and he's not gained weight since birth, then you're going to see them back in a week or two, right? So that's that kind of logic is what I'm thinking about.
And then what about in the older kid?
Older kid, well, if you're above 5 or 6 years old, you need to give it 2 or 3 months, unless the child is in desperate shape and you want to get a weight check in a month.
Praveen, thank you so much for spending the time with us today. As we start to wrap up this episode, I want to ask, are there any other things or thoughts that you want our listeners to know and understand about faltering weight?
There was one thing I've been thinking about. I want people to think of faltering weight as a child being at risk for malnutrition. And if you can think about this way, then it all falls into place. So you want to diagnose it before the child actually has malnutrition and intervene. You don't need to call it that. You can call it faltering weight, but think of it in your own head as the child being at risk for malnutrition.
It's sort of like when we're in the hospital, we want to do the emergency response before the patient actually codes. Like you want to be proactive and catch them before we get to the bad spot.
Correct.
Thank you so much for sharing all of your insight into this guideline. Given that this was a guideline-driven episode, I want to make sure that we take a moment to just give you a chance to share any thoughts on areas for future research, things that might work their way into future guidelines for this.
Most of this guideline was based on expert opinion. We just didn't have enough studies to guide us. So we all sat around a room, a Zoom room, for almost a decade to spin up this guideline. I mean, it clearly wasn't that bad. But the main thing I think we need to figure out is, if we find these kids early and we intervene, will they have better outcomes? So that's one. The second question is all of those questions you asked me about what is the right diagnostic approach. We have no idea. And so categorizing these children and saying this kind of child needs this kind of diagnostic approach would be great. And the final thing is therapy. So how do we provide these kids calories, which is something that we talked about a lot, that would be helpful as well. So those would be the three things that I would think about.
Yeah, and for our listeners who are still learners, early learners, this is pediatrics, and unfortunately, with many of our guidelines, a lot of our guidelines have to deal with expert opinions. So I think that's something that we can always look forward to getting more actual evidence-based guidelines. So I appreciate that you're spending the time with us today to give us your expert opinions as well. Now I think we're going to wrap up. So do you have any last main take-home points you want our listeners to have before we finish this episode?
Number one, never use a term failure to thrive again. It's now faltering weight. think about it as at risk for malnutrition in your own head. Intervene early and first before you set off on diagnosis. And when things are not working out, seek expert help.
You know, the last thing that we always ask our guests here, is there anything you'd like to plug? Any societies we should check out? Any websites? Any things that we should know? Anything from your program? Please, we'd love to share it with the audience.
I think you should check out two organizations that I am intimately involved with. The first is the American Society for Parenteral and Enteral Nutrition. I will be vice president starting in a few months. And then NASPGHAN, the North American Society for Parenteral Gastroenterology, for Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition, which is my parent organization as a pediatric gastroenterologist.
Perfect.
Excellent. Well, thank you again for spending this last hour with us. I definitely learned a lot, and our listeners did as well. Thank you.
Great. This was great. Thank you very much.
This has been another episode of The Cribsiders.
It's for the kids!
It's for the kids!
Catch show notes on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks to our producers for this episode, Sydney Engel, Hart Lidsky, and of course, our wonderful social media team, which is mostly Denise Cruz and XBlueSky and Instagram. I've been Sam Mazur.
I've been Sydney Engel.
And this has been Chris the Chi Manchu. Thank you and good night. See y'all.